murder by experts. Good evening, friends of the inner sanctum. This is your host, inviting you in through the squeaking door. Come in, won't you? We're having a bit of a demonstration here tonight. Presto, the magician, is sawing a corpse in half. And for an extra fee, he'll saw the halves in half. But we'll have to take up a collection of quarters. Don't worry. He won't go out on a limb. Not your limb. He's strictly a torso man, only more so. And if you ever want him to decapitate anybody, remember, he gets $5 a head.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous as ever, information please continues on its carefree path. And tonight, our experts are...
Teresa Kennedy Dupay.
J.B. Fisher.
Okay. J.D. Chandler.
I'm Don Dupay. Tonight,
The River and the City.
On Murder by Experts.
Murder by Experts.
Brought to you by
Peace. It's what everyone wants.
Choose peace.
War is over if you want it.
Portland would not exist without the Willamette River. It has provided food, transportation, business, and recreation for the city's entire history. The Willamette River is a major tributary of the Columbia River, accounting for 12 to 15% of the Columbia's flow. The Willamette's main stem is 187 miles long, lying entirely in northwestern Oregon. Flowing northward between the Oregon Coast Range and the Cascade Range, the river and its tributaries form the Willamette Valley, a basin that contains two-thirds of Oregon's population, including the state capital Salem and the state's largest city, Portland, which surrounds the Willamette's mouth at the Columbia. Let's talk about the Willamette River.
I was just thinking about the eels. Apparently the eels are still there, and yet the tradition of collecting eels in the Willamette River, I guess it still can happen. I guess somehow they survived
the years. I don't know about the eels.
Terrible pollution, but I think Native Americans would collect eels for food.
From Portland, a food biography by Heather Arndt Anderson. For thousands of years, the Columbia and Willamette Rivers and the babbling tributaries that fed them pulsated with fish. White sturgeon, eel-like Pacific lamprey and western brook lamprey, signal crayfish, western pearl shell, and western ridged mussels all provided a stable food source for early inhabitants of the area. Originally a trading outpost, Portland, or as it was then known, the Clearing, was a stopping place for fur traders decades before the first prairie schooner crested the Cascades. early trappers lived much as the indigenous peoples, on the land and close to the bone. From Portland's Lost Waterfront by Barney Blaylock. 5 years after the Oregon City newspapers reported the California gold strike, Portland was described by the New York Times as a prominent and upcoming seaport of the West. Quote, Portland possesses all the requisites for shipping, having sufficient depth of water for trading vessels of almost any size to anchor opposite the city. The article failed to mention that the sufficient depth of water was not available certain months of the year. By the end of 1860, the city of Portland had an impressive waterfront. From south to north, there was Knott's Wharf on Water Street between Taylor and Salmon, Abernathy Wharf at the foot of Yamhill Street, Vaughn's Wharf at the foot of Morrison Street, Carter's Wharf at the foot of Alder Street, Pioneer Wharf, owned by Coffin and Abrams, at the foot of Washington Street, the huge Oregon Steamship and Navigation Company dock between Ash and Pine Streets, and the almost as huge Portland Wharf, owned by Captain John Cooch and Captain George H. Flanders, situated at the foot of C and D Streets. From The Growth of a City, Power and Politics in Portland, Oregon, 1915 to 1950, by E. Kimbark McCall. The Columbia and the Willamette Rivers made Portland. The city's earliest fortunes were derived from river transportation. Portland's location at the confluence of the two navigable waterways in the very heart of a region enormously rich in natural resources preordained its early growth and prosperity.
I've also not been able to determine whether the Willamette historically froze, you know, the Columbia River through the 19th century, and even in the very early 20th century would very often freeze over to the point that it was no longer
navigable. We have the Willamette frozen a couple of times. It seems like it stopped freezing at a certain point, but Fred Merrill, Bicycle King, one of his first successful business ventures in Portland was an ice skating rink under the Madison Bridge.
Oh, okay. Nice.
More than 50 bridges cross the Willamette River. 12 of them are in Portland. The St. John's Bridge, the Burlington Northern Railroad Bridge 5.1, Fremont Bridge, Broadway Bridge, the Steel Bridge, the Burnside Bridge, the Morrison Bridge, the Hawthorne Bridge, the Markham Bridge, the Ross Island Bridge, the Selwood Bridge, and the brand new Tillicum Crossing.
Maybe the 1870s or 1880s, it kind of stopped freezing. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that had something to do with pollution.
Yeah, I think it was a combination, and then later on too, dams and the controlling of the river that also played a role in terms of temperature.
From Portland's Lost Waterfront by Barney Blaylock. As strange as it might seem to us today, the waters of rivers, such as the Willamette, were once seen as a sort of natural force that could dispose of all the waste created by humans. It was as though the river's flowing water could carry whatever it was given down to the infinite ocean. There was even a mindset that sewage would be cleaned by running water, and that a river could be considered a source of drinking water, even if there were towns upstream using the same river as a sewer. From The Growth of a City by E. Kimbark McCall. The sanitary condition of the Willamette River in 1934 was appalling. Samples of the water examined by the Charlton Laboratory indicated practically no dissolved oxygen content between the foot of Jefferson Street and Swan Island. Between the Selwood and Ross Island bridges, where city sewage was observed to be backed up during high tides, the bacterial count was surprisingly high. In September 1937, State Treasurer Rufus Holman personally led an investigating team out on the river to test the water's oxygen count. At one spot, across the Willamette from the east end of the Ross Island Bridge, where a gigantic open sewer released its contents, a score of salmon fingerlings and some mature trout lasted less than 7 minutes after being dumped into a wire crate that had been lowered into the water.
I just love Sam Simpson's nod to the pollution in the river.
Mm-hmm.
With the fragrance.
From Portland's Lost Waterfront by Barney Blaylock. A poem attributed to Dr. Woods Hutchinson, director of the State Board of Health, was circulated by the newspapers. It was a parody of a well-loved poem that was learned by heart and recited by schoolchildren, Beautiful Willamette, written by Samuel L. Simpson. Here are the opening verses of Dr. Hutchinson's version. The beautiful Willamette, from the Cascade's frozen gorges, leaping like a fiend at play, blacker, toxic through the valley, dark Willamette glides away. Onward ever, murky river, rolling sewage to the sea, time that scars us, maims and mars us, is a child compared with thee.
Because I think it was a stinky river. Mm-hmm. By 1946, when they found the torso parts in the river, it was an open sewer.
From Portland on the Take by J.D. Chandler and J.B. Fisher. Bodies in the river had been a recurring event since the first days of the city, but they became routine in the post-war years. About a dozen bodies a year turned up in the Willamette, the Columbia, or along the railroad tracks. Many of them were never identified. Even if they were identified, their deaths were rarely investigated. Throughout 1946, headlines about the torso murder appeared as paper-wrapped bundles of body parts were discovered in the Willamette. Four separate packages were found over several months, containing the dismembered body of a woman in her 50s. The body was never identified, and the killer never found. It was an odd coincidence that Anna Schrader, the private detective who had been the police bureau's gadfly in the 20s and 30s, went missing that year.
The Willamette River, even with that waterfalls and all the other good stuff, is still not such a safe place.
It's a big river and it's a dangerous river.
It's fucking dirty.
It's like cleaner than it used to be.
That's true.
So Anna Schrader knew about the cops delivering liquor, right?
Yes.
And we finally have proof of this.
Exactly. These two letters were explosive when I found them. I was just astounded. I was so excited. Because they're not in Leon Jenkins' personnel file and they're not in Captain Irvin's personnel file either. Those two files were sanitized. And you could come to that conclusion simply by reading the second letter in confidence. April 17, 1930. To Leon Jenkins, Chief of Police, from Captain Frank Irvin. Dear Sir, following the charges which I have placed against Officer John Cortez for insubordination, state to you in confidence that at the same meeting where Ann Schrader made the statement that she had a parking tag fixed, she also made a statement to the effect that she had a police officer who was her friend, who was working in the Record Bureau, who kept her advised as to when police officers and other persons left the police station carrying liquor. We have been some 6 weeks in trying to find out who is supplying this information, and the facts are now before you, as well as the man who has been furnishing her the information. I have been given this information on several different occasions, and each time it led to this same officer. And if loyalty is worth anything to you, for God's sakes, let's put it into effect and punish the unscrupulous, disloyal man who is undermining not only you, but a few of your loyal friends who are carrying on this bitter battle, looking forward to the time when we will be relieved of her dirty, rotten talk and the guilty ones punished. Yours in confidence, Frank Irvin.
I think that she got her feet into the business. The liquor smuggling business that the police department was running, and they found that intolerable. And the letter speaks to that, the battle, and it's no doubt that the people in the police department were trying to protect their liquor smuggling operation, and she was definitely making problems for them.
And because this happened in 1930, this was long before she ever disappeared in April of 46. And what I've noticed in some of the articles I've read is there's several references, at least three, to this explosive information that she's going to share with the media. and the Oregonian, and yet she never does. So I think she held on to a lot of information, information that she probably had gathered by doing surveillance, names, dates, addresses, and she held on to it, you know.
It was the 1930s when she was doing all this threatening and all of this business with Cordes. That was the time that the smuggling was at its height, because
right.
that's when Prohibition was running wild, and the city was bringing in lots and lots of liquor from Canada, protected by the police, stored by the police when it got here, and that's what she was interfering with.
Yeah. So why did she become so quiet?
I've often thought about that, and I've wondered if she was bribed. Don doesn't seem to think she was bribed.
So why do you think she didn't take a bribe?
She's not a bribable person. She's a trouble-causing person. I'm not going to be quiet unless I want to be quiet.
Great.
I think that she kept her mouth shut because she was afraid. Because remember, right after she reported the affair and after Bruning's career was basically destroyed, in one of the newspaper articles she claims that someone shot a bullet through
right.
her window.
Yeah. Well, 1946 is an interesting time for her to disappear too, because Chief Niles got sick. And they brought Jenkins out of retirement to take his place. And she may have seen that, because it seemed kind of personal with her and Jenkins. So she might have seen that as something she had to talk about.
Instinct tells me whoever the torso was trying to get out of town.
Makes sense.
I find it fascinating that she would never be considered a possible
victim,
because she caused so much trouble for the Portland Police Bureau.
Another thing that bothers me about the Clackamas County investigation is that they did such a thorough job up to a point.
You know, I've emailed with Sergeant John Krumenacher, and we've emailed back and forth, and he's shared certain information with me, and we both agree it's probably never going to be solved. There's a lot of questions. I have a lot of questions.
On murder by experts.
Murder by experts.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Ladies and gentlemen, everywhere in America, history is under attack. Many states are attempting to make it illegal to teach history in the public schools that shows our nation in a poor light. If you are Black, Asian, Native American, a woman, poor, Latino, an immigrant, child of an immigrant, gay, working class, or middle class, you already know American history is not pretty. We must never forget that. History isn't free. Support your local historian. Next time.
On Murder by Experts.
Who was Anna Schrader?
She was pretty prominent socially and very active in the Republican Party.
Anna Schrader was very snuggly with more than one policeman.
Yes.
No one's ever investigated her disappearance. I don't think anybody has.
I really think there's a real possibility that the torso is Anna Schrader.
On Murder by Experts.
Murder by Experts.